Hello and welcome to Boothcast. On Boothcast, I speak to people who've inspired me about sport, business, and the winning mindset. Today's Boothcast is brought to you by Booth Training. Booth Training is your online paddling solution to help you get better at your particular paddling sport, whether that's SUP, surf ski, foiling, whatever you like. I'm definitely can help you out. Today on Boothcast, I have Gerd Weisner. Correct me if that's wrong. That's right. Lifelong water sports industry professional. He's been involved in surf, skate, snowboarding, and now SUP. He's had a very cool story growing up windsurfing, playing soccer, and obviously now moving into more of the business side of the industry. And I'm really lucky to have you on today, Gerd. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Boothy. It's a pleasure and an honor.
No worries. Well, it's really cool that you're... I obviously didn't know much about you before I read up about you before we came on air, and you've had a really cool story. So I'd like to hear a little bit about your background and where you grew up and how old you are and why you love action sports industry so much.
Yeah, Boothy, I'm born in Frankfurt, Germany, which is pretty much in the center, in 1968. So now I'm 51 years of age, and I have, let's say, full circles of, let's say, industry heydays of windsurfing, snowboarding, and let's say nowadays in stand-up paddling. So, but maybe just giving you a short summary of how everything developed. When I've been a young teenager, my uncle gave me as a present a windsurf board. I fell in love, passion, complete focus, going crazy. Early mornings, dropped at the lake, and at night, picked up by my mother. And as soon as I turned like 17 years of age, I had friends with cars, so we were driving to compete in events. There have been back in time two leagues. Windsurfing has been super huge end of the 80s. It's been, let's say, 100,000 surfboards sold per year. And the industry was really growing, still growing heavily, and there was money involved. So you could easily find sponsors once you reached a certain level. I made it in 1 year from the, let's say, second league to the top league, where you were competing against the professionals. I was not, let's say, in the international front, but let's say only after 2 years of competition, I've been in the top 20, top 30, and there have been like maybe 300 competitors back in time. But I lost interest after 3 years because I loved windsurfing and I loved waves, and let's say I traveled regularly more to, let's say, areas like Guincho in Portugal, where you have, let's say, mast high waves, and this was, let's say, much more of interest for me, the free side of windsurfing after the competition. But I have this competitive character, so in these days, just to give you the roundup, how I also, let's say, entered into business between, let's say, competitions. It's been something like when I've been 19 years old, I finished school. I already started selling sails and windsurf boards out of the garage of my father. You got the sponsor equipment. It got sold very fast. And then I did need more. So I gave the guys a call and asked, can I buy something and sell it? And they said, yeah, sure, you can, go for it. So let's say at the end of my school career, I already had a little retail store in the garage. It was really garage business. And then after school, I dreamed about, let's say, getting a windsurf professional. I went to France, wanted to hang around there for maybe a year or two. But then my father gave me a call with my grandfather, and they mentioned, you're too clever just to surf. Come back home. You need to study. We found a big company, which was Siemens. It's a big industry company. And they found for a certain group of people the study. So you get an apartment, you get paid, and plus you get, let's say, access to private schools, university. So that's what I've done for the next 3 years. So I teamed up with old friends of mine, and the guy did, let's say, run my little shop. while I was working for Siemens and did my study and surf. And 3 years later, I figured out business is too easy, which was a bit tricky back in time because it was really easy. It was just a booming area.
Yeah.
I mentioned, nah, I stop with Siemens and go full on with our action sports retail projects. So we opened up quite a big store in Frankfurt in the city. That time I was maybe 22, quite young for that. But it worked out really well, but the windsurf boom was finished. So there came mountain biking in to play and snowboarding was growing super big. And as you are, with an open mind, we did snowboard in winter time, but then we took it really as a focus. And in these days, we started a travel organization as well. And we brought in these heydays really a lot of people, like 5,000 people every year to the French mountains to teach them snowboarding. And these days I started training snowboard slalom and alpine racing. And coming to a competitive side, this maybe has been part of my bigger successes in this area. I've been in the mountains like 70 days each winter, so you could do a lot of training and went to all these competitions. Also in these days, we had like demographic wise, you have to see Germany in these days, and I guess all Europe was had super big group of young people. It's different to today. Nowadays you have a demographic which is more like this, and back in time the demographic was more like that. So at this age, like 20 to 30 years of age, we had massive amounts of consumers in the market. So it was easy to build a movement from scratch. So and snowboarding was really just starting. So we were following up that direction from the early days until today. So we did never stop that. Then in these competitions, I made it into international races as well. And I've been, in the slalom, sometimes on the podiums and at least under the top 10 in my heydays. And it's been really professional competitors there back in time because the market was big. It's maybe not comparable to stand-up paddling in regards to the number of participation. In these days, the total market for snowboards, just to give you a number, was 1 million sold units annual worldwide. So this is a big difference to the niche market we are looking right now for the paddle sports.
Yeah.
But just in regards to numbers, not by passion and the workload you have to invest to be at the forefront of the paddle sport today. I guess these sports are more easy to climb up in the rankings because sometimes there's talent involved and it's not so much work. If some gifted people they can easily compete with professionals. Races like 1 minute or 2 minutes. It's a lot about your brain and you have to get into the right mood and for sure you have to do all your training before. But as I said, the part of talent is quite big in these sports. So that was the early 90s and then after 6-7 years competing in snowboarding and developing our companies and meanwhile, just to give you this short summary, we developed our retail store and opened up a new branch. Besides the travel organization, we had a third branch which has been the distribution company. And this is still today existing. The retail store is existing, but it's operating on its own. The distribution company started in 1996, and we were importing some Australian products. You might remember a brand, it's called Mambo.
Mambo, yeah, I had Mambo shirts. A dog that was like farting or something.
Yeah, the farting dog.
That was it. That was Mambo.
Barbecue shirts where old people.
Yeah, I had a Mambo clock, I think, on my bedside table for a long time. It brings back some good memories now.
Yes. Yeah. So this was quite a good success for us back in time. Mambo had its days, and I remember maybe, what was it, 2000 or 2002? They gave product or have been the sponsor as well for the Olympics in Sydney.
I guess for the Olympics. Sure.
Yeah, but it went, let's say, quite big, and then it got sold later to some huge companies, and we dropped out. But this was one of our projects. And in 1997, we started building our own snowboards. And that's when the Light Boardcore brand got started. For the first 4 years, we were focusing only snowboards, technical product. And later on, we started building surfboards because we were always, let's say, board sports people. Then it started, came up for me like a decade of, let's say, free surfing, which was like countless boat trips to the Indian Ocean and surf trips to all these destinations with the companies we were working with. We were one of the bigger distributors for surfboards in Europe for clothing brands such as Rusty and others. We were quite deeply involved in this industry, and wholesaling was working quite well. Internet was not yet developed so much, so let's say it was a time of easy business, to say so. Lots of retailers, and it was more like distributing than selling. These were the good days.
Yeah.
Easy business and lots of free time for free surfing trips. To stay fit and healthy, I played all my life soccer. This was because you have this competitive part in yourself, and soccer is also, let's say, a huge thing in Germany. Maybe a million people, young men, are playing soccer. It's that one sport we have. But unfortunately, let's say, you can hurt your body quite well after playing, let's say, 30 years soccer plus, let's say, a type of professional snowboarding. My knees were not really good at the end, and my doctor mentioned to me, if you don't want to end up in a wheelchair, you should stop that and look for some non-impact sports. That's the thing. I said surfing. He said, yeah, surfing is perfect. Go surfing. But the problem is, I want to do something on a daily basis back home. And I already had, let's say, an entrance into stand-up paddling. Let's say on my surf trips, I used when I had, let's say, usually we're surfing shortboards, but I had, let's say, always a quiver somewhere with some longboards as well for small waves. And I came up to a board from California. It was called the Mickey Munoz Ultra Glide. It's been a 12-foot log, 25-inch wide, and it had like 100-liter volume, which was back in time a super, super big, let's say, longboard.
Yeah.
And I used that one for stand-up and it worked. So this was, let's say, my first step into stand-up surfing, but it was all more based on, let's say, when the waves were really, really kind of ankle snappers and you just wanted to make the best out of the day and there were no waves, then you could still surf. And when I came back home, I thought, yeah, that's the thing. I feel fit, healthy, and I will use this thing on our local river, which is in front of our office. So I did like every day, like 4 or 5 kilometers on this unstable longboard. And then I got a hand on Laird Hamilton board, which was one of the first proper stand-up boards we got here in the market. A big one. Laird is a strong guy. So this board had really volume, like maybe 170 liter volume.
Yeah.
So my distance got much better, so I could paddle for an hour, and it was not so difficult like with this other thing.
Yeah.
And that's quite good. And I thought, well, hey, Gerd, that's the thing, and did it every day. And the next step automatically, what do? You buy a race board. Let's say it was this Yeah, I was already thinking about maybe I can start on a competition. I did not know anybody in the stand-up scene because, let's say, surf and stand-up was completely split back in time. It's
been, yeah, well, it's still pretty split now.
Yeah, it is, and it's two cultures. And we were, let's say, as a company also, let's say, a little bit anxious to embrace stand-up paddling, to tell the truth at the start, because, let's say, these cultures are so different. So what we decided later on is like doing split marketing. So we have, let's say, our SUP part, and we have different websites for the real surf. So the communities can still, let's say, go their own way in this. But everybody who is interested and want to dig deeper, it will recognize it's coming from one basket, the whole thing. So, but let's say coming back to that, that was then I bought a 26 inch race board, and somebody told me there is a canoe club nearby and they make a race for stand-up paddlers. So I entered that race, and I was just came back from a 2 week surf trip in the Maldives. I thought I was surfing every day like 6 hours, and I thought I'm super fit. I will kick their ass and win that race. It must be like that. But the funny thing is, I think it did not even take me 100 meter, and I fell off the board in that race because I was not used to have a start with maybe 50 people in one line. Then some boats, freight ships came around, and there's been cross chop waves, and there was like a harbor walls on the side, and you got the bike wash and all these difficult things at the start. So I fell into the river. And came later, maybe, I don't know, somewhere in the middle of the guys. And I thought to myself, no, yeah, that's not what you want to do. You must train properly and train where it is difficult, because I recognized it's not the flat water paddling. It's about, let's say, getting used to more difficult situations in also stand-up paddling. And it took me like, maybe 6 months, and then I entered my second race, and this was a state title race, and there was the state title race for amateurs, 4 kilometers, and I guess maybe the big guys, 10 kilometers, and as it was just my second race, you could sign in, and there was mentioned, you want to go amateur, or you want to go professional. So I decided for myself, well, I cannot claim I'm a professional, so I do the amateur, because that's something that was a bit weird for me to make your cross on the professional side. So also I thought 4 kilometers is a bit short, because I was that time used to paddle 10 kilometers. But okay, I did it, and I did not still not know many people from the stand-up paddle scene in our areas. But it finally ended up I could win the 4 kilometer race, and as the start line was all together with the guys from the 10 kilometer on this state title race, I figured out I was already in the, let's say, more or less top 10 in this, or top 5 in this area. So I said, okay, next race I will do the big races, and I will make the cross on the professional side. Well, this was the initial start for me to let's say, drop deeply into the racing scene of stand-up paddling, and I never lost it. It's so good, so many nice people, embracing people. I made friends in these two races with easily, let's say, 10, 15 paddlers, and they invited me to join their club, and there is one club nearby, Frankfurt, which is a rock solid club when it comes to let's say more focused training. And I made friend with Hermann Huslein. He's the guy who was 2012 in the London Olympics as a kayak guy. Okay. And he's paddling for his own fun stand-up races occasionally. But the guy is really fast, because he has, let's say, all these kilometers inside, and he has a lot of talent in that.
Yeah,
and then there's another guy, which is Peter Weidert. Maybe you know Peter from some Euro Tour races. He's a one of the better Germans, with Ole and Norman, let's say, at the forefront. And he's also in this club. So these guys teach me how to really paddle. That was, let's say, something that was missing to get the technique. And let's say, especially Peter, as he was coming from a career in canoe racing.
Was he the sea one or the kayak?
The C1. Yeah. So you can imagine the C1 guys, they are like a clock. It's like everything has to be perfect. It's a drill master.
Yeah.
So let's say also in the last 3 years, technique changed, especially as you were so successful and everybody's watching how you paddle. Also the C1 guys changed their technique now for stand-up race. Even if they have a background in C1, it's
a different stroke. Yeah, because I think the C1 guys have their particular stroke, how they paddle, and then there was the outrigger guys, and then I sort of came from a surf ski background, but they sort of, and a kayaking background, so it's kind of, my stroke was kind of taken from that more than the other stroke, so it was just, I guess it's definitely evolving over time.
Yeah, it is. But it's also, I feel for myself, it's good to have, let's say, maybe a couple of techniques, because you can relax parts of your body in between the race. And then you can keep more stamina for all the race. So, and have the power. So then when I joined these guys, I was completely burning for sub racing. Till then, I'm, let's say, more or less every day in the club, paddle my training, and have a lot of good guys where we can, let's say, have our own races every weekend. But that helps you to climb the ladder. And in, let's say, maybe, what was it, 2018, I competed in the Nationals, and there's been, let's say, we have had these ICF rules, I guess, where we had, let's say, different age groups, like the seniors, the masters, and the juniors. So, but then I could end up to win my masters category, but still, let's say, get overall maybe a 10th place or 11th place overall. I never thought about having old man's races, because I dislike that completely. For me, it's much more to, let's say, make the top 10 with everybody instead of, let's say, winning the title of the old man's. But anyway, there is a good competition with the old man's as well, because we have a big group of that. And I think this is typical to paddle sports. The quality is not bad. It's really good. We have, I think, more eager 50-year-old guys than 40-year-old guys in, let's say, our area here. It comes to, let's say, your kids grow older and you have a bit more time for your hobbies, so you get more focused and you still burn, and your body can, let's say, deliver still at 50 for long grinds. That's not the problem. So and then, let's say, in the last year, we have a trophy. It's called the Alps Trophy, which is, let's say, our best summer race trophy in Germany. It's one has been in Austria and the other one is in Italy. This is the whole trophy in the mountains at Lake Garda. And by a little bit of luck, I could, let's say, get the third place overall in this trophy, including everybody, not about age groups. So, but this was, let's say, also due to that three of the top guys made a big mistake in one of the biggest race. They were just turning not around one of the we had to cross, let's say, three islands, and they were just counting two because they had not enough maybe oxygen in their brain.
Never give up.
Occasionally you end up at the front just because of luck.
And what is the sup scene like in Germany at the moment? I only get to really go there once a year for the Sup World Cup. I don't think it's not happening this year, but that was the event I used to always go to, and I haven't really spent much time in Germany other than that. I went to, obviously, the what was that race called? The Euro Tour Bavaria on the Flatwater.
Was it? It was near Munich.
It was a flat water race. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but yeah, I went to there as well. That was cool. But yeah, I haven't really spent much time in Germany. Like, is there a lot of paddlers in Germany paddling SUPs now?
Yeah, we have, well, let's say a lot. I can't compare with Australia, but I can let you know it's like the biggest race we had this year at Lake Chiemsee, which is in the south, was like 100, in total it was like 160 participators, paddlers.
Yeah.
In let's say the rankings, because we have lots of national state areas, like 16 states, and every state has their own races. In total, I guess there might be 400 paddlers in some kind of ranking there, and then they are combined in some national rankings. But it's not really proper. You cannot compare that properly. It's the big thing is the German Championship, where everybody comes together, and the other thing is this Alps Trophy, and then we have something really nice. It's called the Winter Cup. I sent you a picture of that because I liked it. You could see kayak paddlers and sub racers, and it's a race series in winter time, and we all start together on rivers. It's like 200 people at the start line. It's maybe 40 suppers and 160 people in the boat. It's big havoc at the start, and everybody can draft everybody. So you need to be really clever to get to the front. So
yeah.
Now, but coming back to your question, how big is it? The potential is huge, because I recognized that when I came into the canoe club, and now as the ICF is a bit embraced stand-up paddling with the World Championships, the clubs started to open the gate for the stand-up paddlers, and they have they have boathouses at lakes and rivers, and now take the number we have. I think we have something like 1,100 canoe clubs in Germany.
Yeah.
It's a big number. And when we can get, the youth on the sub, it will be a bright future. It's right now I know from our club, the young kids that do maybe kayak slalom or stuff like that, they want to do the sub races as well. They know how to handle a paddle, and you can teach them pretty fast. And once we get this going, it will be a massive amount of people that could drop also into the race team. Taking the number of the canoe clubs, the members, we have like more than 300,000 people in canoe clubs in Germany.
Wow.
So you can see the potential of SUP is big. It's there. In our territory, we do not have, any conflict, between the canoe federation and kind of a surf association. They just, connected together and did organize the German championships all together under one umbrella.
Oh, okay. So the German championships is actually ISA and ICF together.
Yeah, ISA does not really have, somebody taking care for their ideas here. It's under the roof there is the German Surf Association, to say so, and this is ISA, but ISA in reality there is no clubs, not one club existing. It's all individual, and that's the weakness on what I guess it's a bit of a weakness. Doesn't matter. I think they have quite good success here in Germany right now, as surfing got Olympic. And we also sponsor a guy in surfing who made it to, now there are no Olympics, but
2021 Olympics.
Yeah, 21. At least he's in the team, and we can see him in Tokyo sooner or later.
Yeah. So you have obviously a lot of potential for clubs, but is there any conflict between the canoe guys and the kayak guys and the SUP guys, or is it everyone quite accepting? When you go down to the clubs, can you leave your stuff in the clubs in Germany at the moment, or is it no, only kayaks, or how is that working? Or is it all pretty open because of the ICF having the world champs last year?
Yes, now it's really open. So I know clubs that in only 2 years they made it the number of members for SUP, equalized the number of members of canoe guys in the clubs. Yes, and this is why I see this great and bright future, because everybody wants to try out the sub, then they can get, let's say, a lesson in the club. The club can make a little bit of money teaching people how to do it properly. And then the next generation arises and some eager people want to do races and compete against others. And then it all develops itself. And clubs are looking for new members as the demographic changed, and let's say there's less young people and more old people. They have to look for how to get the next members in the clubs, and that's what's going on right now. And it's let's say, yes, place in boat houses is limited, but also because of there are sometimes boats that are 40 years old in these boat houses, so we have to get rid of that, and then there is enough place.
Yeah, I think it's quite cool that there's like a lot of older people in stand-up who do race, because I know, like you say, like your 50 plus is probably more competitive than a 40 plus, and probably more competitive than the 30 plus or the pros, for example. There's definitely more people paddling at 50 than probably is when they're paddling as a junior. But how are we going to get more, or how is Germany trying to get more kids involved in stand-up?
Yeah, let's say There is a the guy who is organizing the Alps Trophy connected together with the Starboard distributor recently, and they make a junior trophy. But just because I think it was right now also an easy access for them to, because there is already a group of young kids doing competitions, like my son as well, and there is clubs from the southern area in Germany who have, let's say, like in one club, I guess there are like 15 kids that want to compete, and the parents are let's say, focused on that as well and drive them all over Germany. So let's say, imagine if we just have, let's say, 30 clubs by 15 kids, so already we have a couple hundred kids that want to compete. So it can develop quite fast and easy. This is already happening. So let's say, I think the lack is more in between the right now, let's say 20 to 30 year old people.
Yeah.
There is not so many. Like, let's say, you might know Ole from your team.
Yeah.
Ole Schwarz. Yeah. He is more or less, I guess, I don't want to forget anybody, but he's, let's say, the standout paddler in his age group. And yeah, he does not have much competitors in the same age. The next guys will be 30 plus, 40 plus to let's say, give him a bit of a hard time. It's crazy.
Well, that's the funny thing for me as well. Like, I am kind of like one of the older guys in the sport, and I'm 29, but I've only been doing SUP for 6 years now. Whereas if you look at like there's like a lot of young kids have come up and just grown up with stand-up paddling, and then the people above me basically have done other sports and then come across the stand-up paddling. So whether they've had a kayaking career, a surf ski career, surf lifesaving, whatever it is, then they've come to SUP at a later age because of the community, and because, I don't know, I guess it's quite easy for everybody to start stand-up paddling, because you can just get a 30 wide 10-6 and you're a stand-up paddler. Like, you don't have to sit in a kayak or something like that where it's quite hard. You don't have to go try and learn how to surf. You just stand on the board and you go, and you're a SUP paddler. So I think that's what's been really appealing to a lot of people, because they can see someone do it and they can do it really quickly straight after. Was that when you were doing windsurfing in your early days, was it quite elitist, or was it like a lot of recreational windsurfing as well?
At the start, it was a lot of recreational windsurfing and very easy access. So, but we had this like different leagues. There was this, let's say, Olympic type of windsurfing, which was based, you do not need a certain limit of wind force, and mm-hmm. everybody can do it on a lake. And but then there is this more, let's say, action-driven windsurfing, where you need, let's say, a good gust of wind to really surf. And then it started to get elite, because the boards get more difficult. Let's say when I traveled, I can tell you, and that's why I lost interest a little bit. I had to travel with like 80 kilogram of excess luggage to the destinations. Yeah. So if you had, let's say, a race in a foreign country, you can imagine it's been like dropping freight somewhere and getting it out and back in time. There has been customs officers involved, and everything was difficult. So
yeah,
it's been a big logistic headache. But you needed to have, let's say, 6 rigs and sails and maybe 2 boards at least. And if you are unlucky, you break one, let's say, after 10 minutes.
And then you need another one.
You have to borrow something from a friend. It's been, and that's why, let's say, it got too difficult. And that's, I think, why windsurfing went down in numbers.
And when you stopped windsurfing and you started your garage brand or your garage sales, or who were you actually selling at that point? Were you just selling your own stuff, or were you selling like different brands that you were bringing in and on selling, or was you bringing in a sponsored gear out of your garage? Was that how it all started for you for business?
Yeah, when it all started, I just had my sponsor equipment, and after a year, you exchange it, you get new ones. So, and back in time, you got it for free. It was not like you have to pay, let's say, a good price for it, because the market was massive. Let's say the guy I was working with, let's say, take just the sale guys. They sold in Germany maybe 400,000 sales. So it was not a problem to sponsor, let's say, 10 guys in your team. It's been a massive business, but as I did not have any, let's say, relationships to other brands, I just sold the product from my sponsors in the garage to all the people I knew. And that's how it started. And I also worked, let's say, back in time, I remember it was all too easy. Boat trade show 1989, for example. This you know the boat trade show? I guess you have been there in Düsseldorf.
I actually haven't been there, but I have heard of it. It's like the Düsseldorf show, and they have this standing wave there as well.
Yeah.
I think Fiona and Zane go every year.
Yes. Yeah. That's the one, and it was much, much bigger end of the 80s. It's been super huge. So we were selling, let's say, I remember sales there, and I was working for that company for, let's say, 10 days at the booth, and made a lot of money in that time, because they gave us 10% commission of each sale. And when they asked team riders to work there, and I think I sold every single day something like, what was it? Maybe 40 sales every day, just by myself. So I thought that's why I told you, end of the 80s, it seemed like this business is so easy, I have to do it. It was, let's say, the market was demanding so much.
But why was that? Because like in the 80s, was just windsurfing just massive? Like everybody wanted to windsurf in the 80s. Was that like basically what was happening, or?
I guess, Boothie, it's there has been no computers back in time, no mobile phones back in time. Mountain biking was still not existing.
Yeah.
And let's say windsurfing was this one big thing. And let's say Robbie Nash was a complete hero all over the place. And let's say it was the heydays of the Quicksilvers, where let's say all this marketing, let's say, worked full on. So that's the thing. So, and it's like, it's trend is your friend. So everybody was following the same path. That's the thing. And later on, it just split. People were interested in snowboarding, in mountain biking. And we lost a lot of people to, let's say, whatever, esports, or I don't know what they do.
Yeah, they just went to different sports, and they just weren't probably as interested in windsurfing anymore, because I guess they got exposed to different sports, and they were just like, oh, maybe I'll try something different. And I find that people have different lifetimes in sports. Like I know for myself, I think like every 5 years I tend to change sports. So I at least dabble in a new one, because I don't know, I can't help myself. I need to learn something different, but I can still be good at something else. And yeah, I found that personally for myself. But so once you finished windsurfing and selling for windsurfing, you started your Lightcorp brand, and you were getting into surf and skate. How did that sort of start? Were you just really interested in those brands at the time, or was it you were over windsurfing, or why did you get involved in that?
It was the next big trend let's say, leading the trend of snowboarding, and build the market myself with a couple guys. And this was, let's say, when we were super successful with teaching students snowboarding. And let's say in these days, early 90s, we really had winters. It's much different to nowadays. Like winter was from us, we could go snowboarding from September on the glaciers here until April. So we had, let's say, really like a full half year of snow conditions around. So it was not an easy access as well. So, and so this was the next big thing, and it was easy. Let's say snowboarding is more easy than skiing. Some people think skiing might be more difficult, but in reality, everybody can learn snowboarding in 3 days. It's not so bad. Let's say once you do it quite really good, it will take your time, but it's been like the demographic was, let's say, female women and men, everybody, young and older people. It's a little bit like stand-up paddling. We could get everybody onto a snowboard, and that was let's say part of this big success. And once you have, let's say, the business success on that side, it's accelerating itself. So yeah, people are start talking about it and get all their friends involved there as well. So this was when we were, let's say, thinking about what is the next step. We do school part of the snowboarding. Let's build boards. And I was doing, since the early days, these competitions in alpine racing, which was interesting as well, because it gives you, let's say, the right mindset, and you learn a lot about your body. You need to be these sports are, when you're at the start line, you have to be absolutely focused but empty in your head. If you're not empty in your head, you will not reach your goal and be in the forefront. And it's a little bit like Zen, or I can't tell you. It's difficult to find this state of your mind, but it's part of the success. And I would call it maybe visualizing your goals. And this type of thinking is something that is following all my, also let's say, business career. You visualize some things, you dream about that, you go into bed and think, that's where I want to end up. And later on, you do it automatically. It just comes intuitively to you. And there is sometimes it's just a split second where you have to drive a decision, and you hopefully find the right decision because you had all these things already thought a couple months before. And you are so...
Yeah, it's like finding the zone, I guess, that athletes talk about when they're racing. They get in the zone and they just stay in it, and they're focusing and they're making sure they're picking the next stroke perfectly. They're getting the boat run properly. They're doing everything right. And I think that's sort of what you're talking about with business. You're seeing the trends and you're picking the things that are obviously going to expand, you're going to enjoy, and you're going to see people obviously embrace. And you're able to make a living out of that. And obviously snowboarding was that in the 90s. Was snowboarding and skiing big before that? Or was it really not really well known before the 90s?
No, skiing was super big. And there was a big fight back in time. It's a little bit like the ISA, ICF story. I had that personally myself in the 90s in competitions with... there was the Snowboard Association and there's the Ski Federation. And the Ski Federation took over, let's say, or wanted to take over the Snowboard Association guys, because it was the same story. It got Olympic. And once the Olympic idea is involved, we are talking big money. And because of the big money, the Ski Federation started and said, now we make our own competitive series. And all the guys from the Snowboard Association back in time, we said, nah, we don't compete in your races. We have our own ones, and they were very well organized and everything was perfect.
Yeah.
We did not have the media time, let's say, in our prime television. There were the guys that were competing the Ski Federation races on a snowboard. And I remember there was this, let's say, in slalom, I had one competitor who was, let's say, head to head with me in most races. Yeah. This guy got a world champion on the Ski Federation side. And he had, let's say, 20 minutes interview on our prime television station, where the, let's say, the absolute best guys on the on the Snowboard Association side back in time, world champions and guys like you, European champion, world champion, he did not get 1 minute and he was much faster. But it's been just, let's say, this leverage of the big federation that later on took over everything, because let's say money rules the world, and that's how the direction changed.
Yeah, it might happen in stand-up, I guess, as well, but we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, it's. I think maybe they are open-minded and they will say, and I think Surf Association in reality, let's say after snowboarding, I was, let's say, doing nothing else than 15 years of completely free surfing, real surfing. And I went to all the trips. We built up, let's say, to be one of the leading guys selling surfboards in Europe, real surfboards, and with for different brands, license projects, our own brand, and stuff like that. So let's say a big number of, let's say, the good snowboarders turned in summertime to get real surfers, which is for me one of the most difficult sports you can do technical wise, and yeah, to find the sports and all these things, it's to let's say you also need the physics, which is, let's say, good when you do a lot of stand-up paddling, you stay much fitter for real surfing as well. But just to tell you, I think the core side of the real surf is something that never embraced, let's say, the paddle sport. And if I look at the ISA, there is a lot of it's a lot of surf, let's say, in their DNA. So yeah, I don't know if they really embrace, let's say, the stand-up paddling full on. That's the reality, what I feel. And this is something that is cultural-wise a bit of a problem between surf and stand-up paddling. It's not my point, but you could feel it all over the place. Like when I go with a subsurfer into some core areas, I have to prove that I can do it on a very high level. And if I can't prove that, they will all give me some fucks.
Tell you to go away really quickly. It's a really interesting one. Like, I don't know who can do it better or who's better out of the ICF or the ISA. Like, I think that's really out of our hands. I think that's been pretty clear from the get-go, but I just like it to be sorted out and we can actually move forward with our racing and actually have a clear pathway and actually have some sort of structure, because if they keep fighting, then we're just not going anywhere. And that's just a matter of fact. We need to sort of speed this up, and instead of them sitting in court for 2 or 3 years, like, let's just get on with it. And I don't know whether they merge or one takes over, or just like, they need to make a decision so we can get on with it and I can go racing, and like, and then event organizers can know what to do. The industry knows what to do. Like, we all can all sort of just start to fall into a certain pathway or a certain pattern. Cause if you're a junior, especially, like, they don't know what they're like. We just go to an event that someone runs each weekend, or do we go to a world championship, or we go to this world championship, or we go to the APP, or do we do the Euro Tour? Like, which one do we do? Like, which one's the most important? For us at the moment, I guess it's just like which one the industry wants us to go to. And if there's another world championship, we go to it, because that's usually where the best guys are. And we, at the end of the day, just want to race. Like, I don't really care what the title is or what the name is on the top. I just want to race against the best guys each week and prove myself.
I agree absolutely. I think that one good solution could be, let's say, the ISA takes care for sub surfing because it's a surf sport. You just use the paddle to get out and to catch a wave, and then it's surfing. Mm. And if they could, let's say, find a kind of a joint venture, I think then it would be a clear path, and everybody could live with that. But let's say, okay, that's politics. Let's see how it goes. But there is one good sign in the world, I think, besides, let's say, all these things. I have been twice at the Glagla race in France. You have seen these pictures and the intro video. Yeah, I know you have not competed there, but you should do that. It's massive. I've never seen a lineup like that. It's like 700 people on a starting line that is maybe 900 meters long or a kilometer long.
It looks like a really cool event. I'd like to get there. It's always been at a bad time of year for me, because obviously I start racing in April and then I finish racing in December, and I'm just like, I don't want to do any more. But I definitely like to go there, and if it happens in this winter period, I probably will go, because I'll be itching to do a race, and if that race happens, I'll be there.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. So if there is, let's say, some organizers doing iconic races, these iconic races mean a lot to, let's say, the core community in sub racing. And the concept of, let's say, getting the pros together with the, let's say, avid amateurs, and also, let's say, maybe bloody beginners. I don't care, because they make one big start line and they tell, okay, you have to do the big round for everybody who wants to go for the 14K competition. And we have something for those who want to, let's say, sniff and they can do a 6K race. But yeah, everybody's on the same start line. And it does not disturb. It's no problem for the professionals. But it's a good feeling for all the community, because these people go back home and then they tell, have you seen there has been, let's say, maybe a young guy like Ty Judson, who is in let's say on the forefront right now of the international sub racing, or you could see Tiku at the start line, and so yeah, it gives something to everybody, and they will start talking about it, and more people get involved. That's what I feel is absolute special and different. Let's say you could not do a windsurf race on a high level with, let's say, some amateur guys. It will not really work out. Maybe yeah, conditions difficult and security cannot be offered and all these things, but let's say on within the stand-up, this is all possible, and it's I know so many people studying, let's say, the result sheets of that race, and they compare their times to the other guys, and it doesn't matter if you are, let's say, just thinking for yourself, you would just think about the top three, top five, top 10. And let's say for me, I think about, I want to make it to the top 20 or top 25 or top 30, whatever I could reach there. That's the thing. But yeah, I set my own goals. And the other guys, he wants to knock and get into the top 100 and so yeah, on. So they have, let's say, a year of what I said, visualizing their goals, and they feel as good as in the front. And I remember that from my own racing. At the start, I was just thinking about who can I catch up next. This was and later on it gets more difficult. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, that's exactly how I look at it. I'm like, when I was first starting SUP or doing surf ski or whatever I was doing, I was always trying to pick off the guys in front of me. Like, there'd always be a name in my head. I'd be like, okay, if I can get him. And then now it's like, okay, well, maybe just try and stay in front, and then if you lose, you lose. Just, it happens, it happens. But what I really like about those races and those community style races where everybody gets to start together is you do get that feeling of, okay, so I don't know, you get to line up with Titouan Puyo or Ty Judson or Connor Baxter or whoever turns up, and like they're on the same start line as the person who's going to get 760th, you know, like everyone starts together and everyone gets that sense of I'm in a race, you know, like you don't really get that. You can't really have that, like when we sort of have those elite type of races where like there's only 20 guys or 16 guys or whatever it is, or it's a sprint race and there's like a lane, or like you don't, it's not really a race. You don't have the game. You don't really get to go, oh, if I get off a really good start, I can sit on so-and-so's wash for as long as I can. I'm going to hang on, you know, like there's all those little cool stories that people get so excited about. And when you're sitting in the beer tent after the race and you're having a chat about the race, they're the stories that people remember. They're the ones that the workers go back and tell their work colleagues or their friends and family, oh, I stayed in the top 50 for, I don't know, the first 3 kilometers, and then I fell to pieces, but I was still in the top 50, you know, like that's, people love that stuff. And I really like those races. I think there should be more of them. Like even when we started in Bilbao, there's always like 200 people starting at the same time, or the Paris race, there's obviously waves, but it's still like you're paddling through a sea of paddlers. It's kind of, I think it's really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, also, let's say, I think it adds some excitement. For example, you can, let's say, point out new dark horses. It's just amateur guys who could maybe match up with some of the top guys, not at your level, but let's say just the level below. And I remember like last race at the Glagla race, there was a guy I was paddling once with from a paddle club in Villa do Conde. Renato is his name. And the guy got seventh in the Glagla race. And nobody had him on and could recognize that he would be, let's say, the next guy behind the leader group. It's I love these stories. So it's so great to see that. And I know this guy is really training hard and focused, absolutely focused. He cannot compete, let's say, in international races, more or less. But let's say he came up there, was very well prepared, and could make it in the top 10. Great story. And and then you have, let's say, guys like Norman, who is our team rider. You know Norm Weber?
I know who he is. I'm not sure we've actually caught up or met before, but I definitely know who he is. Yeah.
Yeah, but Norm is a kind of a character. He's coming from downriver paddling. That's his career path. And he has been a professional in this. So when he started stand-up paddling, in the flats, he's super fast. In the sprints, he can be super, super fast. He's, let's say, has his difficulties for sure as a landlocked paddler, more or less, in the open ocean. So that's when he smoked and you will not recognize him. But when it gets to the flat areas, last year he was runner up at the Glagla race, and this year he was in the top three always, but he got, let's say, kind of sandwiched on the last buoy, so he could not place his paddle between the boards. And let's say he's also, for me, something nobody, let's say, has him on his record list and would say he can win a race, but he has it inside himself, he can win, let's say, really big races as well. He gets, let's say, only focused on that, because the guy is still doing a lot of boat races and world championships there. So there is, let's say, these crossover athletes, they are also in our sport. So it's let's say, it's not like, let's say, Formula One racing, where you know at the start of the season, okay, it's either Vettel or, who can win, or let's say one of the top three guys.
Yeah, Lewis Hamilton.
Here in our races, there is still room for some fresh messages. Let's say, besides Bruno, you and let's say your standouts in when it comes to the long grinds. But what we missed was the ICF in Qingdao. If I would have known that the race is kind of as good organized as it has been, we might have gone there as well with some of our team guys, but it's been out of our focus when we heard, let's put your product into container a couple months before. And then we thought, somewhere in China, I don't know.
It was definitely a well-run event to a point, and then it obviously had its issues as well. So it was a bit frustrating, obviously, before the distance race. There was a fair bit that went on. They were running the race and they weren't running the race, and they were running the 200-meter race, and then they were going to put it on for two laps. And it was just like, come on, guys. I was getting a bit upset, that's for sure. But eventually it all turned out and I got to do a good race, which was lucky for me. But I didn't even have my board. My board didn't turn up because of logistic issues, and had to borrow a girl's board before the race started. It was just always a nightmare. But I'm so used to everything being a nightmare that it almost the nightmare becomes the norm. So you're just used to everything going wrong.
It's that happens all your life. It's there's most of the time it runs out good. I saw that race live on the stream, and it's been a tough one. Lots of wind and chop, and I guess, let's say, weak legs in the last part of the race for at least Bruno. So when he made this super wide boy turn.
Yeah, he made a big mistake there, that's for sure. But he did it on every turn. So I was like, oh, I think he's going to do it again. I remember having a chat with him the other week, and he said, I made a big mistake on that turn. I was like, yeah, I was waiting for you to make it in the last lap. So I had to be very patient. It was an hour and 20 minutes, I think, of patience. And then I got to make my move. But sometimes it's that war of attrition. You've got to win. Interesting for me, you were talking about setting up your Lightboard Corp in Bali, and you were obviously making boards for different brands. How did that come about? Because you said, like, I think DHD and Paizel and, I'm not sure if they were the brands, but different brands like that you were selling to Europe for a long time?
Yeah, now it's been in 2001. We decided to, let's say, embrace the market for real surfboards. It's been super tough to tell people there is a German Cook brand that is selling real surfboards for real surfers. So no one would buy that. That's the thing. So we said, okay, we know what we are doing, but we need to, let's say, find the right fundament for that. And let's say there was a lucky incident that an old friend of mine went to Bali, married a Balinese wife. And we decided to, let's say, start the real surf branch from Bali to let's say give it the right DNA to get it properly grow and work from there. So what we've done is we made in the first year some clothing in Bali, I remember, and we started building some surfboards at third party production, but we were absolutely unlucky with the quality of the product. So and Basti, the guy who is running the company and owning the factory, he nowadays he just mentioned and said, "Get, I want to build my own factory there because we can, let's say, rely on quality and do it everything properly." And then we said, "Yeah, let's go for it. Give it a start." And a couple of years later, the Light brand in Bali is quite well known. We sponsored, let's say, the best locals. They have won on our boards, I think, yeah, three times the Padang contest, which is something like, let's say, the pipeline of Bali.
I've surfed there, yeah.
Yeah, so it's been, let's say, a good track record there, but as it is in real shapers, business is, let's say, import-export from Bali is super difficult, so it's not easy for Australian companies to ship surfboards to Bali with the customs process and sell there. So what they do is they look for someone who can, let's say, manufacture the boards under their shapes and teach shapers, ghost shapers that can do so, or they, once in a while, they drop, like, maybe get to Bali themselves and give the last finish of the board. And nowadays with CNC machining, it's quite easy to prepare all this upfront and then make, let's say, a good number of boards in a short period of time of lengths. And that's what happened. So let's say that the quality is well known from our factory and Basti, let's say Basti's factory, he's our licensee in Bali. Today he has, let's say, granted the lifetime license. He earned it, so
yeah,
good for our marketing for as well. That's the thing. So he is taking care for big shaper brand names there as well. And let's say for us, we always had, let's say, a really good photo coverage events going on. We are co-sponsor also of the Padang contest, and that's how we, let's say, yeah, put the roots to our real surf project. And that's the same I'm thinking about, let's say, stand-up racing. When we dropped into stand-up racing, for me, it was not about, let's say, making some inflatable product like everybody was doing. If you just look for on the commercial side and you want to make money, then that's what you do. But if you want to give it, let's say, a proper base, then let's say, for me, it was like, we want to shine also on the prime events and show the people that we are there and that we can, let's say, compete against big guys and very respective brands like Starboard is, for example. But we don't want to be the XYZ brand that is selling in a mess warehouse just, let's say, inflatable product. We want to be innovative, and we want to, let's say, do what we can do to sponsor some quality paddlers and see our baby grow. That's and be innovative as well. So, and you know, I don't want to talk much about it, but we were the first who put, let's say, hollow race boards into the mass market. And this is like 3 years ago, so there was a learning curve. We are, let's say, partner of Nelo, and it's all moving on. Last year, Bruno was on our boards, and unfortunately, we lost him. But it's not due to, I think, that he's not happy with me and I'm not happy with him. It's just like well, he was maybe too successful for the budget we have. That's the reality. Yeah.
That happens sometimes. I guess we all have our different expectations. We all want to keep progressing forward, and sometimes we can't do that, and we've got to look forward to our different opportunities. And I guess he's found a new one with, is it X-Bionic or something? Then I don't know exactly what they're doing. They're making a new board maybe or something. We will see. And I think we'll be waiting a lot longer now with the whole situation with the COVID-19 and everything now. So we're not sure when everything will come out, but it'll be interesting to see. It's always cool to see different brands come in and different paddlers pop their head up and different, all sorts of different things. It makes it exciting. Like, I'm sure there'll be new paddlers coming along very soon that'll be knocking on the door or knocking us off. And it's, I love it. I love the challenge. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, we have a new guy in the team. You know him, Claudio Nika.
Yeah.
He's our new, leader in the team. He also has a world champion title on his belt. So, Claudio is really young, super talented, at least in sprints. So, I think, if he gets his mindset right for grinding, he's so young that there is potential. And
he's a very good paddler. He's been really cool to watch over the past few years and see his improvement.
Yeah, actually, he's together with a German girlfriend, so maybe he starts speaking German as well.
Yeah, and, does that make him better?
I don't know. Hannah is, I guess she's motivating him as well. So
no, I meant, does it make him better that he speaks German now?
It may be more easy in communication with the team, but he's right now, he's speaking quite well English right now. So, because none of us is speaking Italian, that wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah. I know he's definitely gotten better. He's English. I've obviously spoken to him over the past 3 or 4 years. And when I first met him, no English, but now I can actually have a conversation with him. I had a few conversations with him last year. It was quite cool because obviously I should learn Italian. I'm half Italian, but I don't know Italian, so maybe one day, but I don't think so. But do you sponsor obviously different riders in like snowboarding and surfing and the other sections of and apparel? I guess you have as well. Like, do you help out lots of riders there as well? And is that part of like the philosophy of the brand to sort of try and be the best in your different areas?
As long as we can pay for it, real surf is much too expensive to, get a hand on one of the CT guys. It's crazy times in the, 90s or 2000s. These guys earn a couple $100,000 a year from their sponsors, so from the main sponsors. So that's something, can't get that. But what we have, we have the best, in national guys sometimes in our team. And as I said, now we have Arne who has been qualified for the Olympics on the German side for real surfing. We had a guy, Andy Schwartz. He's a South African free surfer from, the parents went to Tasmania. I met the guy as a boat guide in the Indian Ocean, and he made it as one of the top guys to Red Bull videos, and we sponsored him as a free surfer. And I like in real surfing, I like the aspect of free surfing a lot because a lot is based on how judges vote for you in competition. So it's different to those races we are doing where the clock counts and it's just as it is. So I like that much better. So for surfing, I think there can be good sponsorship reasons to go with the free surfer if the outcome of the videos and the photos is good enough, and the guy is really a good character, it's perfect. So we have these guys and
It's just like I guess surfing is very subjective. Like, it's not based around like the clock, as you say. You can't finish the race and know that you're the winner. Like, you finish a wave and you think you've done the best wave you can score, and then you don't get the score, and then you don't understand why, and then it's just based on someone's opinion of what you do. Whereas racing, we can actually go, no, we are the best because we finished the race first. Like, there's no excuse if you don't finish first, you know. Like, I just like that so much better than like those subjective sports.
It is fair. And then there is something else. I did one real surf competition myself in, let's say, early 2000s. And it's been like you are waiting for your heat, which is then 30 minutes. And once it's yours, maybe the tide has changed and you have 30 minutes of closeouts in front of you.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, nah, that's a waste of time. It's not good. So it maybe for young guys with it, it's and professional surfers are really good in most in all these conditions, but it's really it's not easy. This is really, really difficult.
Just out of interest, like, did you always think you were going to go down this entrepreneurial route where you were creating businesses as you went, or was it just something that came to you? Like, when you were younger, did you think that you were going to go into like a certain industry and work for somebody, or you're always like, I'm just going to make it up as I go? Because that's something that really interests me about people who go into business.
Yeah, I think it was, for me, it's a bit going with the flow. I was addicted to all the action sports from that young age. And as I started doing business when I was not even 20, everything came into automatically. It's been just evolving from there. And you know that there has been some, let's say, lucky incidents. For example, I can remember, it's a bit of a funny story, when we were still in our, how could we fund our distribution company? Because let's say money takes, it's quite a lot of money involved. We had the retail store and like 94, a Japanese guy entered our store and he said, you know, I need snowboards. And I said, yeah, we have snowboards here. And he said, yeah, but I need lots more snowboards. And I said, how many? And then he mentioned, I need 2,500 snowboards. And I said, oh, okay, that's a bit out of our range. How could we? And this was the back in time, let's say, the gray market stories of snowboarding. Japanese prices were way higher than those in Europe and the States. And in these, let's say, couple of years, it's something we can, nowadays, after 25 years, we can talk about that. It's been many retailers got lucky because they got orders for a couple thousand snowboards. So, and that was like, okay, 2 million turnover for snowboards. Thank you for that year. Yeah. So that's how we could start our distribution project. And that's what I wanted to tell you. Sometimes go with the flow, you get lucky in this direction, but on the other side, you get once in a while hit hard. Like, let's say, take the disease right now, the pandemic, or in between, let's say, we're facing difficult times in business as well, where you just have to stay focused. And I think the real guys, they will always be stay in the market because, let's say, they have the core customers. That's what I think. So, little example of how it goes.
Yeah. So. And how are you dealing with the situation with COVID-19 right now, obviously business-wise and personally? Like, what's it like in Germany at the moment, and what's it like for your business structures?
Yeah. Let's say from the personal side, it's not bad. We had, let's say, an incredible April right now. The weather was blue skies and warm, sunny, so let's say that's good for your mood. We are still allowed to go paddling, so let's say individually or maybe in groups of two.
Yeah.
Let's say not all clubs are closed. We don't have races for sure, but we can do our training, so which keeps your mind clear and you are not missing too much from your personal side. That's okay. Germany itself, you did not see too much havoc around the pandemic. So it's like our hospitals are still running fine. So that's why we have, let's say, not the same situation like in Spain, France and Italy. We are not in a complete lockdown where you cannot leave your house or apartment. So we are, let's say, that's all still free. Since last Monday, our shops are opened again. We have to keep distance, but let's say they start the system running right now.
Yeah.
from the business side, it was, let's say, yes, sure, it was hard for the first 2 weeks because you don't know what to expect. You are calculating, okay, this is my cost I have. How much turnover can I do? Maybe nothing. How long can we stand this? It's maybe nerve-wracking a bit. But let's say in April, we figured out, let's say we had loser item product categories like real surfing. We cannot sell surfboards now to France, Spain, Italy, and even the German surfers. They are not allowed to travel to the Atlantic Ocean. So,
yeah.
And Germans, let's say, a nation of traveling people. Like, I see lots of Australians coming to Oktoberfest and traveling all around Europe.
We're definitely a traveling people as well.
Yes, that's it. So now we are locked. We're really landlocked, and we can just embrace our rivers and lakes. That's what it is. And we have, let's say, a little bit of coastline in the north, but we are also not allowed to travel there actually now because they don't want to, let's say, get too many kind of tourism going on. So it's still calm. But let's say what was good for our business was, and that's, let's say, the beauty if you have, let's say, lots of branches. Skateboarding went up like this in the last month, because what do parents do? They buy a skateboard for their kids. They don't want to see them just playing digital things and hanging around on their telephone. So I've never experienced skateboard sales like this April in the past years. So
yeah, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and let's say stand-up paddling as well is going in line expectation and did not, let's say, fall down too much, or at least not yet. So I hope it stays like that. And especially, let's say, race sports is something those people who are focused on that and they want to train on the right equipment that they are planning to use for the future competitions, they place their orders. So as long as, let's say, we get not hit hard economically in the next year, I think we can, let's say, get back to regular rhythm, but you never know what the effect is right now on the economics. And it looks like it can get very, very difficult also in Europe, at least in Southern Europe. So it's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, I think that's something that it's hard for everybody because nobody can plan for anything because nobody really knows what's going to happen. There's no precedent that's been set that we can go, oh, okay, in 3 months' time, we'll all be okay. Or in 6 months' time, we're all going to be okay. And then we can plan, but we can't plan because we don't know what's going to happen, I guess, until we have some big solution. But there is no solution at the moment. It's just about biding our time and trying to just deal with it the best way we can. But what's next for you, I guess, coming into the summer season, maybe next winter season? Like, what are your focuses, or can you plan for anything like that, or are you just seeing how it goes?
We put a lot of focus right now on the stand-up paddle side. I just developed a couple new boards, and these will be released in the next 2 months. And our product rhythm is different to, let's say, those, let's say, maybe windsurf brands where they have annually new product launches. We make a product when we have a new product, and the product might run for 3, 4, 5 years. It's like more like the real surf stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not this seasonal driven thing. But so this will be exciting, and we can push this category and work on there. For winter sports, in fact, it gets really difficult because we don't know if ski resorts will open, if we are allowed to cross borders. So I think the smartest way right now to handle it is wait and see. It's nobody knows. It's hard.
It's such a weird situation to be in. I think I don't know if something's happened like this in your lifetime, but it definitely hasn't happened in mine. And I never thought that going into this season, I was planning for a big year. I was supposed to go away for like 4 months, like 3 days ago, and obviously not happening. So we'll just have to wait and see and see what happens.
Uzi, I had that once. This was the SARS epidemic, And I went to a surf trip to the Maldives that year, and no Australians have been there, no Americans have been there, no Asians have been there, because you had to go in quarantine when you traveled outside your continent. And I surfed the best waves of my life in that time, just alone in front of these islands with, let's say, two or three friends. And for 2 weeks, it was a crazy time. Absolutely yeah. empty, perfect breaks. And so this was the nice story around that. But all the other things, if I can trade off, I would, let's say, rather surf with a lot of people there. But
yeah.
And now, today, it's even worse because nobody can travel. I think there has never been in life so many empty waves in perfect locations.
Yeah, well, I can't even... I'm actually not allowed to travel outside. I think it's like a 50-kilometer radius that I'm in at the moment. I'm not allowed to go... Because Western Australia, I think, is the biggest state in the world. And we can't move. Like, we've got, like, maybe 3,500 kilometers north and then, like, 500 kilometers south and then, like, 1,000 to 1,500 kilometers inland, and we can't move outside our little region. So hopefully that opens up very soon and we can actually at least travel around the state, because it's something that I'd like to do while I have the time, because it'd be really cool to see so many amazing spots. We have such changing landscapes over here.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that. We still do business with Rusty, and Rusty is located in Perth.
Okay, and I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's let's say it's a local brand for you. They yeah. took over. They are the owners right now. They bought the company from California.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. And how are they going? I haven't heard of Rusty for a while, actually.
Yeah, I think it's the only. You have these big three like Billabong, Quiksilver, and Rip Curl, which are all, let's say, have been on the stock market, or let's say right now, like also Rip Curl run by some big companies. They just sold the company from the original founders, or bought the company from the original founders. So I think, let's say, from the next group of all, let's say, heritage surf brands, Rusty is one of the only healthy surviving brands that have quite a level already and are privately owned. That's the thing, because all the other guys are right now public companies.
Yeah, they're all bought out by private equity, and they didn't really survive, and they got into lots of debt, and they made bad decisions. Like, I think Quiksilver and Billabong are owned by the same parent company now, and there's like obviously a lot of different stuff going on in the surf industry at the moment, and I think that's a whole other issue, I think.
It is, and I think, let's say, when we are speaking about economical hits in the pandemic, I think, let's say, that clothing industry will be hit quite hard. Because let's say this is just a luxury you don't really need. You can keep wearing your t-shirts you have, and if you cannot, let's say, go out into a restaurant, bar, parties, and so on, there's not so much reason to buy some fresh fashion. That's the and this is, let's say, now we are the small niche guys, but we have a core story to sell to our consumers, and let's say before you. I would buy, let's say, a couple new pants. I'd rather buy a new surfboard, or let's say a new stand-up.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, like, obviously I've been a bit more careful with my money at the moment. And there's all these things I want to buy and all these toys, but I'm not sure when I can use them. So I have to be so careful. But yeah, everyone's been pretty good to me. So I think I'll be able to purchase some new toys and go for a few trips at least in Perth coming forward. Is there anything you want to add before we jump off air? Is there anything you want to have a shout out to or anything like that?
I want to greet, let's say, all our team and the team riders around, all the paddle friends we have in Europe. And it's let's say, for me, I'm pretty thankful with the new friends I made in the paddle industry and the paddle competitions. And it's something very rare, because we do not fight against each other. It's more like a family business. We have competition, but it's a very, very good mood, and keep going.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thanks to thanks for obviously coming on, and obviously hello to all my friends in Europe, and obviously in the countries that are really struggling, like France and Italy and Spain. from Australia. We're definitely thinking of all you guys. If you wanted to listen to this back or any of the other Boothcasts, you can check out Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and you can check out all the videos on Michael Booth on Facebook in a section called Boothcast. Thank you so much for coming on today, mate. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks, Boothie.
Thank you. See you later.